Hello, I have Jeanette Robinson Flint on the phone. Hello, Jeanette.
Hi, Arnold.
Well, Jeanette, you are the executive director of Black Women for Wellness.
That is correct.
And could you explain what is that group and what does it do?
Well, Black Women for Wellness is a grassroots, community-based organization empowering Black women to live our full potential. And we basically do that through health education, and advocacy.
Now, did you start this or help start this?
I'm one of the six founders of the organization, so there are six of us. And we went to the Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing, China, back in 1995.
Mm.
There were 40,000 women there from all over the world, and it was wonderful and fabulous. And we thought, we need to do something like this back in L.A. I mean, start an organization, not bring 40,000 women, though that's not a bad idea.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was where the seed was planted to begin Black Women for Wellness, because we saw so many women who were activists and advocates and fully engaged around a platform of action with women and girls. So we came back to Los Angeles and started Black Women for Wellness.
There wasn't anything really for women. It was mainly a male world's version of what women's health was and practices. Was really that the case?
Well, you know, it's still pretty much the case when we start talking about the health and the healthcare world. All the gains that women make and still have to make in the healthcare world is an uphill battle. We have been fighting, for example, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act for women's health issues. Ever since we started this journey, and thankfully we have been successful, it has been, can we get reproductive health included in this? Can we get birth control included in this? Can we do family planning? Do you think we could get a mammography along with that? So when we talk about women's health, we still have to fight very hard for inclusion. In California, they actually closed the Office of Women's Health and decided they would open an Office of Health Equity. And as they were putting together the structure, the charter, the philosophy for this Office of Health Equity, they totally left gender off the table.
Hmm.
So we had to talk with the folks at the state level to say, okay, it's wonderful you're having the Office of Health Equity, but can we include gender? Do we have a gender lens that we can include? So it's still a struggle to get women's health included. And this happened in 2012. So I'm not talking about ancient history here.
Really?
Well,
that seems amazing that you know, mammography and health,
family planning
and reproduction, they're still knocking on the door. I mean, that is amazing. That it's not under the umbrella of...
It is now, but I mean, when I think about this, they approved for free that men could get Viagra free before women could get any type of family planning method for free. You would have think that the least they could have done was approve that together, right? But no. And did men have to fight for Viagra? All righty.
Interesting, yeah.
It's been an interesting struggle. So I think it was just this morning that the Violence Against Women Act was passed.
Yes.
In Congress.
Yeah.
Just this morning. So, yeah.
With 138 people against it. I mean, that was the sad thing.
So we still have a little way to go on these issues of gender, on issues of women's health.
Do you lobby to the public? Do you lobby to politicians? How do you...
So we're a nonprofit.
Right.
We do advocacy. And when we do advocacy, there are several, or at least three different places we can do advocacy and where we do advocacy. So one is with our community. Right? We need our community. We need that groundswell of community support. So we are continuously doing education and information sharing with our community. And in the same way, they do education and information sharing with us to say, you know, Black Women for Wellness, these are some of the issues that we are facing. This is some of the trials or challenges and tribulations that we have. So that's the back and forth in terms of what's going on with the community around advocacy. Mm. Then there's the administrative advocacy. Mm. And for example, Black Women's Wellness has a program where we work with environmental justice, the intersection of environmental justice and reproductive justice. Mm. So when we're talking environment, then we're talking to the Environmental Protection Agency or FDA. So those are administrators. And then we ask them to change or impact policy so that it comes down to us. For example, the average person, and I want you to think about this, uses 12 products a day. Okay? So from soap and toothpaste and deodorant to washing your dishes, just your regular everyday living type of thing. Mm-hmm. And of those 12 products, it's approximately 126 chemicals in those products. Mm. So when we started thinking about what is the cumulative impact of those products and can we get, is there any regulation on that? And we found out there was none. One of the biggest offenders is the cosmetics industry because they put this little thing called fragrance in everything. And when you say, well, what's fragrance? What is that? Then they say, well, you know, that's proprietary. We can't tell you our secrets. So that's the administrative advocacy we do. So we ask EPA and other administrative organizations to please regulate some of the beauty industry, some of the chemical industry, so that we can go into the store or the drugstore and not need a degree in chemistry or be a scientist to figure out what to use that's healthy for us.
Indeed. And have you had some success? Can you get people to move?
We have had some success. And I'll bring you to one of the successes we've had was with having BPA banned in baby bottles and sippy cups. So BPA is the chemical that makes plastic soft. And you find this chemical in 98% of Americans.
Because 90, did you say 98%?
98%. We all are using all type of plastics, especially these water bottles. Mm. So there was a bill in California, AB 1319, that was passed last year, and we were one of the sponsor supporters of that bill. And that bill bans the use of that chemical in baby bottles and sippy cups. So next they're going for formulas.
Wow, so at least we can keep it away from them when they're young.
Right. We don't have a lifetime of this cumulative impact. And then, you know, even just beginning to shift. And this is going back to the community again in terms of how do we do advocacy in the community.
Yeah.
So how do we shift our community to, instead of buying all these plastic water bottles, to use reusable containers? We want folks to drink water, right? But we don't want plastic bottles everywhere. So what type of containers can we give people that they recycle and reuse to reduce the number of plastic bottles? So that's why I say when we do advocacy, it's at least three different levels where we have to do the advocacy to make it effective.
Mm, very interesting. No, that you get so granular and to the nitty gritty of that. I think that's great. You know, it's not just cerebral.
it's not cerebral, and you can't just do it at the state level or the policy level, because we want to make sure that the policies that are being passed have a positive impact and don't have any unintended consequences on them. One of the other policies that we passed were able to successfully work with was AV 499, and this is in California. We're not talking national here. Mm-hmm. And that allows providers to offer preventive health services to youth. Mm-hmm. So what we had was a lot of youth who might go to their provider for something, and the provider saw that they needed, a screening for sexually transmitted infection, or they might need information about birth control, but now providers are able to offer those screenings and treatments to minors if they have them in the office, as opposed to sending them home and having them get permission from someone else to come back. And that helps because, you know, it's very hard to get, you know, to remove all those barriers that get you into a provider. And once you get a person into a provider, you want them to get as much help as they need, as much service as they require.
Excellent. And you helped in that campaign?
Yeah.
Well done.
One of our victories, yeah.
Indeed. Now, to come into this field, what is your background and what really inspired you to move into this field?
Well, you know, what happened was, I love saying that, it's like one of my favorite like little phrases. I was pregnant and had a big argument with my OBGYN in the pharmacy. And I thought, you know what, I got to find something different. This is not going to work. And I'm going to do it my pregnancy my way. So I went and found a midwife. Uh-huh. And that took a lot of work. It really took a lot of work because we're talking, you know, X amount of years ago.
Right.
And so that really introduced me to the fact that I had to be empowered as a patient or a client. So the doc had prescribed a medication that was harmful to a growing fetus.
Mm.
And the pharmacist pointed that out. No, I read it while I was waiting for the prescription to be filled, asked the pharmacist about the medication, and it happened to be a woman pharmacist, and she said, no, you shouldn't be taking this. So she called the doc, and that's how we got into a big argument in the pharmacy. It was literally in the pharmacy, and that's why I knew I had to read, and I had to take control of my own health situation.
Well, so you really can't rely on your health givers necessarily to give you the right advice.
Well, you have to work with them.
Yeah.
You know, you're the captain of the team, and you get to work with them, but ultimately you have to make decisions, and you have to be aware of all the things that are going on with you. So, and get enough information from your providers and from your team of folks that you can make good decisions that, you know, empower your health, as opposed to letting someone else, what I call, take you away with the white coat syndrome. Like, you know, whatever the white coat says, I'm going to do it. Mm-mm. Can't give away your power like that.
Right.
And that's part of where we were as women who started Black Women for Wellness. One of the other women that started it, helped start the organization, had found a lump in her breast.
Mm.
And, you know, all of us thought, oh, my God, she has cancer. What are we going to do? Blah, blah, blah. And what we found out was she had a cyst in her breast. And then we, well, what do you do about a cyst? Because now it's like, whoa, not cancer. Well, whoa, what's a cyst? What does that mean?
Right.
And we had to really explore diet and nutrition and find out what was contributing to the cyst in her breast. And what we found was it was really very much driven by the caffeine that she was drinking. She was a huge coffee drinker.
Wow.
So she cut back and then cut out the caffeine, and the cyst disappeared.
Wow.
So now this was over a process. You know, this took time. It was over a process. Took a lot of research and a lot of work, but it wasn't being driven by the medical community. It was being driven by us because we wanted to know. And that's when we decided we'd do a program called Keep in Touch, which was a breast health education program where we taught women to do their own breast self exams. We taught them questions to ask, et cetera. So they would be empowered around their own breast health.
When did all that start? How old is your daughter now?
That daughter, see, now you ask, she's 28.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, but like I said, that was what started me in the health field, but what started Black Women for Wellness was was the seed was planted at that Fourth World Conference on Women. That was in 95.
Is that the one? Yeah, Hillary Clinton went to. Was that that one? I seem
Hillary
to remember
Clinton
that.
Was there? Yeah.
Isn't that great? I mean, where inspiration comes from, you have to allow it in, wherever it may come from.
Sure. Yeah. Or sometimes you have to venture out of your normal avenues to see something a little different. Who would know that this, you know, young black woman would show up in China with her friends and run into Hillary Clinton and, you know, a number of women who are just really strong advocates from across the world. You know, we saw lots of women from Africa. We were in a conversation with Palestinian and Israeli women. I mean, it was just a wonderful experience.
It'd be great to find out all those how all those connections have grown from that one conference all around the world.
Yeah, what impact it's had. And I know they're still working on the next one, on the Fifth World Conference on Women. Because who knows what we'll do if we all get together again and bring friends and sisters and cousins and mothers and aunties and daughters.
Yeah, you might get equity one of these days. Who knows?
Just a thought. Justified.
Yeah. We keep it in the back of our minds, you know.
And then struggle for it.
Indeed, you know. And no, obviously you've struggled for reproductive healthcare, specifically for black women, but really for all women, really. Isn't this the case?
Yes, absolutely. You can't help one set of women unless you help all women. Because it's one of those things, as long as one of us is, you know, incarcerated, or what is, until all of us are free, none of us are free, type of thing. So yeah, we work with everybody.
Well, exactly. But again, is there within, you know, is there a racism there, a medical racism between, you know, say, whites and blacks? I mean, just like in schools and different things like that, have you fighting that?
Is interweaving into the fabric of this country. There's just no way around that. So there is racism everywhere. Like I said, is interweaving into the fabric of the country. A lot of us choose to ignore it. A lot of us choose to think that we're in a post-racial United States because we have President Barack Obama. But even in how he and First Lady Michelle Obama are treated, you see those tinges of racism.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's just interweaving into the fabric because we seem to simply refuse to deal with it face on and to deal with it in a way that offers dignity and forgiveness and healing and equity to all that have suffered from racism, because it's not only African Americans who suffer from racism, but it's everyone that suffers from racism in one form or another, because it does not allow us to be the best we can be. When we talk about health, and looking at how racism shows itself in health, we can look at the health disparities that African Americans face. African Americans have the highest infant mortality in California and in the country. So when we talk about infant mortality, what we're talking about are dead babies. So African Americans, for every 1,000 live births, 11 will die. That's the most. If we're talking about Latinas, it's 4. If we're talking about whites, it's 5. If we're talking about Asian Americans, it's 4. So, and then you think, well, wait a minute. Then for African Americans, it's 11. There's a problem there. What's going on?
Yeah.
So when we talk about maternal mortality, how many women die from giving childbirth? Same thing. African Americans is double that of others.
Oh, my goodness.
So when we look at sexually transmitted infections, we look at women with HIV, it's just, if you look at even something I talked a little bit earlier about breast cancer. Mm-hmm. African-American women are less likely to get breast cancer, but more likely to die of breast cancer. So it's the health disparities really paint the picture of how racism impacts our community and our culture. So it's very startling, and sometimes it's very discouraging when I start thinking about our health statistics, which I think I do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah,
but
I bet.
You know, it lets us know that there is plenty of work to do, plenty of work to share.
Well, that's it. Yeah, with those type of statistics, you know, like, there isn't a one-size-fit-all thing, is there? There's got to be adjustments to it.
Yeah.
Does that happen in the real world, or really it doesn't?
You know, we struggle every day to figure out where we can create equity in the world. That's why we were excited that there's the Office of Health Equity opening in California, and why we worked so hard to get gender on the agenda, as opposed to saying, oh, no, not Office of Health Equity. We said, oh, this is great. Let's talk about how do we create balance. Let's talk about how do we get health equity. But let's make sure we include gender as part of that conversation. So, and when we look at the Affordable Care Act, what this does is it opens the door for more people to have continuous coverage with their health care. It closes the door on people being kicked off of their health insurance because they've reached a cap or a lifetime cap. It makes sure that insurance companies cover people. So if you have a chronic illness or if you have a catastrophic illness, that you don't have to worry about losing your health insurance. And if you have a health disparity in your community, then that's a good thing.
Mm.
And that's leading us toward creating some type of health equity.
Indeed. As long as it's being recognized, that's the main thing, isn't it? Yeah.
And recognize, no, we have to do more than simply recognize. We have to take action.
Oh, yeah.
We have to take action.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you certainly seem to take action. You are on a lot of other boards. What other, how do you have time? I'm looking at the list here. How on earth do you have the time to do all this work?
Well, I'm in my office at 8 o'clock at night.
Okay.
There you go. On a Friday, no less. So I think one of the things that happens is I really enjoy my work.
Yeah.
And this feels like my mission.
Yeah.
So when it's your mission, you do it because you enjoy doing it and you enjoy seeing the difference it makes in people's lives. Sometimes just even seeing a light bulb go on in people's, you know, head, like, wow, when they get something or when something happens, that's good. So that's how. It's the mission. If this was a job, I would be wiped out.
Right.
I'd be done, right? So yeah, it's the mission.
Yeah, seeing that inspiration inspires you, in other words, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was interesting. I was just looking at this. I got sent this survey that just came out, statistics about African-American attitudes on abortion, contraception, and teen sexual health. Did you check that out?
I did check it out.
Yeah, it was interesting. Some of the statistics, I was quite surprised, actually. You know, say about abortion and things that a much higher percentage agreed with some of these issues than I thought would be in the black community, tell you the truth. I felt, you know, certainly during the last election process, certainly with the gay marriage and things, that there was quite a pushback from the black churches. And so I'm wondering, what is the effect on in the black community and to these findings?
Well, let me give you a little bit of history. I think just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the 112th Congress came, the one before now, they came into office saying that they were going to work on the economy. They were going to fix this economy. We were going to deal with unemployment. We were going to find jobs. But rather than do that, they really attacked women and worked on women's reproductive health issues. You know, abortion was on the agenda, family planning was on the agenda. It seemed like every month they were talking about Planned Parenthood right. on the Hill. And at the same time, they had this whole conservative, I want to say conspiracy, but they had another part of their conservative team that was really working on the ground level also. So they were putting up billboards in African-American community that were very, very insidious in how they would cause guilt or shame or and good about conversation around the issue of abortion in black communities. Now, they only put these billboards in black communities. And then in Los Angeles, they put them in a couple of Latino communities. But they would put up billboards that said black and unwanted. Or the most dangerous place for African-American child is in the womb.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So the African-American community was assaulted with these billboards in Los Angeles in January of, what is it, of 2011, right before, the day before Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday parade celebration, they put up 75 billboards, most of them along the route of the parade.
Oh, my goodness.
So African-Americans had an opportunity to think about this issue a little bit and to check in with their family members about this issue. So we were absolutely delighted to be called together with a number of the organizations serving African-American women, with Sister Song, with Sister Love, with Spark, with Black Women's Health Imperative, with Black Women for Reproductive Justice, to say, you know, what kind of information do we need to talk, you know, to share with African Americans about how we're truly thinking and talking and feeling about these issues.
Right.
So we're delighted that BRS was able to put together this national poll, having asked the question of African Americans about, you know, what are your values? And the first one they said was, all women deserve access to safe, affordable, and quality health care services. Well, that's a no-brainer for me, because, you know, if we have a community that's suffering from health disparity, of course we want our community to have access to safe, affordable, and quality health care services. So then we found that 8 out of 10 African Americans of all ages, religious persuasions, believe that abortion should remain safe and legal and be available in our communities. We didn't carve that out of having access, right? Why would we carve that one issue out? So, and when we did the survey, it's like, wow, we don't carve that out. And then 9 in 10. African Americans says efforts to prevent unintended pregnancy using sex education and birth control are preferable to making abortion illegal. So once again, we went to say, you know what, not only do women deserve to have all options available to them, but they deserve the information and education they need to make informed decisions.
Yeah, it's even in it was looking at the sex education and teen sexual health. That was interesting. You know, this all in the 90% in terms of people agreeing basically with the need. But it was interesting right at the bottom. Interesting one, slightly different, is healthy romantic relationships. I mean, it's still got to 78% as a need, but interesting, because you'd think that from that would spring a lot of the other percentages.
Well, you know, I thought it was pretty interesting too. Sometimes my biggest worry about our relationships is the media. When I look at the media in terms of how do they convey relationships, they do a very poor job of relationships. And it's not only for African Americans, but particularly for African Americans. The media would have you think that a relationship can be, you know, formed in forever in a half an hour, or solve every problem in an hour.
Right.
They would, you know, have you glorify romance and not let you know that relationships take you being there and doing the work and staying with it on a day-to-day basis. The challenge, I thought, was that a lot of folks who have been, you know, married for 100 years or, you know, like my parents have been married for a very long time, they're not talking about how they maintain their relationships. And those are not the people in the media talking about, this is a healthy relationship, and this is how you nurture it every day. And, you know, sometimes you do get hot, or, you know, those type of things. Yeah. And we don't get to see those models nearly as much as we should to know how to maintain those relationships. So it's interesting that 78% is high, but you would think that maybe we should have 100% to talk about healthy relationships. Yeah. But then the other thing is that, you know, people define healthy relationships in different ways.
Yes.
And people might be afraid about, well, I define my healthy relationship like this, but you define it like that. So maybe we stay a little bit on a neutral territory when we start talking about what's a healthy relationship and how do you maintain them.
Yeah, a lot of nuances there.
Yeah.
Now, is anything coming up, any big events or happenings, votes, anything that people should be aware of and working on?
Well, let me say this. Black Women's Wellness has a website, bwwla.org, where we post what's coming up and what we're participating with. And you can find information about our events coming up at that website. We are having a conversation on March 8th, which is International Women's Day. Mm-hmm. So that morning, we're having a conversation about the impact of violence on our health, and an international conversation in Los Angeles on that impact of violence on our health status. How does it manifest? How does it show up? Why we need a Violence Against Women's Act? And how does it impact women in different countries and different cultures, et cetera? And then that evening, we're having a celebration. We're having art and poetry and spoken word and music and dance just to celebrate, standing shoulder to shoulder with our sisters and the resiliency that it gives us. So that's coming up just in terms of what we're doing in March and celebration of Women's History Month. We also will be posting policies that are pending. Mm-hmm. Right now, California is still finalizing what bills and policies will be on the agenda for the year. And the more we know, the more we post what's going on there. That's where you can find information about us, about policies that will be impacting women at bwwla.org.
Mm. Wonderful. Now, it is, you know, Women's History Month, and what women have inspired you?
Oh, well, you know, I have to start with my nana. So, I grew up in an extended family household. So, my great aunt lived with us, and that is like, she was a person who was home when I got home from school every day. Mm. So she was the one I got to talk over stuff with. She was the one who was that connection to the past in my family and the connection to the future. Mm. So that's whose shoulders I stand on. And, of course, my mom, too. You know, I had to laugh because I call my mom and say, Mom, I'm having this issue and that problem. And she'll say, have you tried this? And I'm like, you know, you should write a book on management. And she was like, yeah, like who would read it type of thing. So those are the two in my family. When I think about the heroines in my life, I think about Ida B. Wells. Mm. Who was a journalist. I'm from Chicago. She landed in Chicago. She was from Mississippi. But I love the fiery words and the way she used the pen as her sword and her weapon of choice. Mm. So Ida B. Wells is one of those heroes that I look up to also.
Great choice. Well, Jeanette Robinson Flint, thank you so much. Fascinating interview, and what experience and knowledge you have about the subject.
Well, thank you for for the chat, I'm delighted.
And
to have been able to chat with you. It was so easy.
Well, I appreciate it, and appreciate you staying at work to do it as well.
Ah, no problem. None whatsoever.
Well, I hope all the celebrations go well this month, and keep up the incredible work.
Thank you, and do feel free to call again if you'd like to chit-chat about what Black Women for Wellness is doing here in Los Angeles.
I would love to do that. I appreciate that.
Okay.
My skin is black, my arms are long, my hair is woolly, my back is strong, strong enough to take the pain.